Welcome back to the podcast. I'm Pastor Donovan Riley. We are going through the letter of James. This week it's chapter 4, and as always, I'm joined by Pastor Eric Brown.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Pastor Eric Brown was on a 7-second delay this week, coming from the coast.
Actually, who knows what they had to bleep out of there or delete from there, because I you know, bridling my tongue, man.
Bridling your tongue. And at the soundboard, producing and audio teching us, is Pastor Christopher Gillespie.
Hello.
You know, we could do like a totally unnecessary bleep edition of this, and it'd be really fun.
We do that. It's called the simulcast.
That's right. Totally unnecessary and bleep.
Yes. Totally unnecessary, and we could just bleep it out. This week, as I said, we are on chapter 4. Coming out of the fruits of righteousness sown in peace amongst us, where we stopped last week. Pastor Brown, is there anything that you want to recap about last week, about chapter 3, before we leap into chapter 4?
Chapter 3 really dealt a lot with the burden of those who would be teachers, who would be pastors, but it does also play out to all Christians, I think, with the importance of making sure that when you speak, when you teach, you are prepared to be speaking of mercy, forgiveness, the things that Christ does, lest you put it upon yourself and it all goes to pot. It's like right. The end of one of Luther's prayers for pastors, where it's only be thou with me, for if I'm left to myself, I would bring it all to utter destruction. If you take your word of spirit away from me, I will set the whole thing on fire, and not just a small fire. It will be Gehenna, the everlasting fire pit fire. Happy thoughts.
Happy thoughts. That was a Norman Rockwell painting.
Oh. I like the Kincaid paintings where they have Star Wars figures.
That's right, Thomas Kincaid with Star Wars. Yeah, yeah.
The walkers blowing up the village and stuff like that. I like those.
Yeah, yeah. Look them up. Google them. The fruit of righteousness is sown in peace amongst those who make peace. From where are conflicts and from where are quarrels amongst you? Is it not from this, from your pleasures that wage war among your members? You desire and do not have. You murder and are filled with envy and are not able to obtain. You fight and you quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, in order that you may spend it on your own pleasures. You're adulterous people. Do you not know that friendship with the world makes God your enemy? Therefore, whoever wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you think that in vain it was useless that the scriptures say the spirit which he caused to dwell in us desires jealously? But he gives greater grace. Therefore, it says, God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Therefore, subject yourselves to God. But resist the devil, and he will run away from you. He will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded people. Lament, mourn, and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning, and your joy, well, you should be gloomy. Mourning. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will raise you up. Do not speak evil of one another, brothers. The one who speaks evil of a brother or judges his brother speaks evil of the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge of the law. There is one lawgiver and one judge who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you to judge your neighbor? Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will travel to such and such a city and spend a year there and carry on our business and make a profit. You who do not know what will happen tomorrow, what your life will be like. You're like a breath. You're like a vapor, a mist in the morning that appears for a short time and then disappears. Instead, you should say, if this is what the Lord wants, we'll live and we'll do this or we'll do that. But now you boast in your own arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to the one who knows to do good and does not do it, to him, it is a sin. Thus endeth the lesson.
You know, that whole thing sounds like it's just riffing off the book of Matthew. I mean, think about the beginning part of Matthew, the temptation, the Sermon on the Mount. It's dovetailing with that so beautifully. And again, if you want to treat James like, oh, well, James doesn't talk about Jesus. No, he's kind of knowing that you've heard the gospel, or at least assuming that you are familiar with this whole, resist the devil. I wonder if there's a place where, is there a story that we have in the scriptures where the devil flees? I don't.
That's right.
So there's sort of, he's expecting some sanctified common sense and connections will kick in here.
Well, and it's important to remember too, though, that the people he's writing to don't have a New Testament.
No. But what do they have?
They have the scriptures, right? And I think this is key, though, is that we're conditioned, we're also dog Gentiles, but we're conditioned to run to the New Testament when we have Jesus questions. For James's readers and all, you know, Christians of the first several centuries, you went to the what's called the Old Testament for proof that Jesus is the Messiah. You didn't run necessarily to you didn't have the Gospels. You had the scriptures. And all James is saying here is, if you want to know who Jesus is, if you want to know what, you know, quote unquote, a Christian life is, go back to the scriptures.
Nah, they've got Matthew. they're Jewish. They've got the Jewish one. Matthew writes stuff quick. He finishes off the scriptures.
Right. That's right.
And they've all got it.
It's the unabridged version. Before it went into publication. So where do conflicts come from, according to James? Where do quarrels start?
Well,
we just got done with an entire chapter about your tongue.
So peace, guys. Focus on Christ. And hey, where do your lack of peace come from? Why? I love this. How did you translate that word? Is it pleasure? Is it passion? What comes up there?
Pleasures, desires.
The idea is stuff that you don't really need, but you think you really should have.
Right.
Which describes so much of life in the U.S. I mean, this is not a matter of the normal fights we get in aren't, I'm stealing a crust of bread to feed my family lest we die.
Mm-hmm.
But it's rather, I want stupid stuff because stuff.
And it's the prayer, thou shalt not want. It's the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Not I shall not need, but rather I won't want for anything because the Lord is my shepherd. That our wants, our desires, those things that give us pleasure, according to James, that's our problem, actually. That's our primary problem, is the things that we think we can't live without, that are needs, they're just stuff that make us happy or give us that warm fuzzy. My favorite TV show, my favorite cartoon, my favorite book, my favorite person. I don't necessarily need them, but I want them because they make me feel good. And so he says, you have these, you have these desires, these passions. You desire, but you don't have what you desire. You murder, and you're filled with kind of envy, but you're not able to really like get your hands around the thing that you want, and you fight and you quarrel over it. I mean, he calls Christians murderers. Like, he's accusing them of being murderers for starting fights.
Well, if you heard the Sermon on the Mount, that makes perfect sense, even though you'd say they haven't heard it. But that's neither here nor there.
I said they didn't have the Gospels to read. That doesn't mean they didn't have the teaching.
Oh, okay. All right. Now we've reached harmony. I can go with that.
That's sanctified speculation. You're free to believe that they had a fully functional Bible, if you'd like.
No, just Matthew.
That's right. Just to prove my point. As long as they have what I need.
Yeah, listen to me. I'm teaching in righteousness.
Oh, that's right.
Now we're going back to the previous chapter.
That's correct.
I had a prof at OU in my undergrad who taught, had him for an undergraduate history class, like introductory history. And he had one of the greatest lines to simply explain how you can understand what history is. He says, when you look at history, remember that human beings are pleasure-seeking missiles of flesh.
Yeah.
They will do what they think will cause them pleasure. And what does that lead to? Well, if you've done history, you've probably come across war, chaos, troubles, all the stuff that James is warning against here.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea
don't is, be like the people around you, the culture that you are living in, you dispersed Jews.
Why do the worst things go on in society? Think of, you can think of any of the news stories that go on, whatever week this happens to be, whatever time, if you pull this out 3 years from now and listen to it, I'm sure the news stories for the previous week will have been full of people doing stupid things chasing after their pleasure.
There will be
wars.
There will be murders. There will be people envying other people and demanding that they get what other people have. There will be fighting. There will be debating.
And at the root of it, all misguided desire. Mm-hmm. Sinful, selfish desire, that appetite, that covetousness, that mm-hmm. wants more and more, that wants what God has not given to you.
And you don't have them because you don't ask for them. That's the thing. He says, you don't even ask for the things that you want. You just try and take them.
Ooh.
And so you ask, but you don't receive because you ask with the wrong motives. Remember, pray for wisdom. If you're not wise, pray for wisdom. First chapter. And now he's saying, the reason that you don't have the things that you want is because you don't ask for them. And the reason that when you ask, you don't receive them is because the reason that you want them has nothing to do with wisdom.
Okay, Pastor Riley, I'm gonna have to cut you off here.
Mm.
Because it seems like you're saying that I should be passive and receptive and just get blessings from God. But I'm supposed to be a go-getter. I've been taught all my life as an American that if I want something, if I just work hard enough, I will mm-hmm. go out and I will achieve it. So let me go figure out what I want. I've got to have passion and I will go.
Right. And you will spend it on your pleasures, as he says right here.
Wait.
It's like the old Janis Joplin song, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz?
My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my life.
That's right. Why pray for what you want? Because all my friends have something, then I want it.
Well, it becomes one of the things we can forget just how ensconced in wealth, how much we are catered to as Americans on the basis of what we want, our pleasures. Everything mm-hmm. in society caters to that. I mean, if you think about it, most commercials are absolutely, utterly wicked. They're designed mm-hmm. to make you angry, upset, and unsatisfied unless you buy something. By yeah. the way, this coffee by Gillespie is actually fantastic.
It comes fresh. It's made to order.
Nice plug.
But consider the world that, again, consider the first century. Consider to who he's writing to. Consider the people that are living around him. There are Zeus worshippers. There are Persians worshiping their gods. There are Romans and Greeks and Africa. There are all these different cultures worshiping these other gods, and they're all making a fortune off of it. Remember, Paul and Barnabas are constantly getting in trouble for ruining the local economy because people hear the gospel and convert, and the local silversmiths are going out of business because no one's buying statues of Aphrodite or Diana. That people are rich worshiping other gods. You know, the psalmist complains in the psalm, I think Psalm 73, about the fact that, you know, people that chase after false gods get rich and fat, and all of his friends want what those people have who chased after other gods. So then they go, and then they become rich and fat. And he's wondering why he's the only guy left standing in church worshiping this dumb god who doesn't seem to care about his well-being at all. And then when he goes to run away, he realizes that the reason he can't run away is because God's had a hold of him the whole time. And that it wasn't his faithfulness that kept him in place, but rather it was God's faithfulness to his promise that kept him in place. And here we have James, I think, making us the similar thing is, look around you at the culture you're living in, wherever that may be, whether it's Greek culture, Roman culture, North African culture, Persian, you know, Middle Eastern culture, wherever you're living at, the people around you and the gods they worship. Well, Greece is a crumbled empire. Rome is an empire. We see empire. We see wealth. We see all of this money. We see all of this success happening. And these Christians don't have a homeland. They don't have, you know, a family to go back to. They don't have a church to go back to. They're strangers in a strange land. They're aliens. And they have no rights. They have no privileges. They look around them and ask the question, well, why am I worshiping this God who seems to benefit the poor? Like James says, if you're poor, you'll be rich in faith. And they're looking and going, well, can we be rich in faith and rich, just rich? Can we do both? Because when they go to their temple and sacrifice their animal to their God, they seem to get like success. Like they have a full harvest. Their business is doing great. They're happy. They've got kids. They don't seem to have any problems. Us, on the other hand, that seems like all we have are problems.
Well, you know, the cool kids go to that church, or they're right. in this program, or this thing, or you know, the good-looking women are over at the Methodist church, or whatever. Probably, that's probably not, necessarily true, but I ran into a guy in town here. Like, oh yeah, I grew up Lutheran and married a Methodist, so that's where I go now. Oh, great, good job.
Chase your pleasures. And what does James call them though? What does James call people who chase after their pleasures? Adulterous people.
Well, again, now there I will go. That is totally Old Testament theme there, right?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. The bride and the bridegroom, Hosea and Gomer.
Is there any point in the Old Testament where adultery and idolatry are not instantaneously connected? I mean, they're not. I can't think of
pretty much synonymous because the analogy holds pretty much all the way through Israel's history.
As soon as you start going with an idol, there's adultery, and vice versa. And I mean,
which is different. Again, that is a different relationship that Yahweh sets up with his people than any other religion ever. That I'm not like a slave master and you're all my little slaves, my little minions running around scurrying to please me. I'm the bridegroom. You're my bride. We're married. This is an intimate relationship between me and you. I want to be with you. And this is the way I want you to understand our relationship. All other religions, all other practices, all other theologies around Israel, and again, around the people who are receiving this letter from James, require sacrifice. And their understanding of their gods is, we are the slave of the gods. We're slaves of the gods. We're just little minions running around, and the gods come down every once in a while and play with us. And as much as they give life, they take away and give us death. As much as they bless us with wealth, they take away that away from us and give us poverty. And so the gods are, you know, the other gods are kind of petulant, childish. We can't really trust them. Yahweh's like, no, I'm your bridegroom. Like, we're married. Like, that's our relationship.
All right, now I'm going to ask you a question, and I want you to riff off of this and answer, all right?
Yeah.
So then why do you have things like Paul saying he is a doulos of God, or all that, the Old Testament sacrificial system? Mm-hmm. What's going on there with that? Because you have so much of that similar language, but what's the difference? How is that playing out in saying, I'm a servant of Christ? I like, Paul, a servant, actually, doulos, it's slave.
A slave, yeah, it's doulos,
so,
a slave,
so
right.
So what's...
Bond servant.
What's really being brought out with that, even using that language that almost overlaps?
Right. Well, the easiest way to understand it is just to go read Philemon. But since we're in James, we won't do that. But rather, the language that Paul uses is that Jesus bought Paul back from his slavery to sin and death. And that Jesus is a different kind of master than Paul's former master, sin and death. So that Jesus went and said to sin and death, how much does it cost me to buy Paul from you? I want him. And sin and death say, well, your life for his life. That's the price that you have to pay. And so as our own catechism teaches in the second article of the Creed, it's not with gold or silver, but with his suffering, his innocent suffering and blood, that's the price that Jesus pays to become Paul's master. So it's not like he says to, you know, Paul says to Onesimus and to Philemon, you receive Onesimus as your brother, as a fellow Christian, not in a master-slave relationship, but rather Onesimus will serve you as your slave, and you will serve Onesimus as his master in an earthly sense, but that in Christ you are brothers, you are equals. And so in the same sense, Paul is saying, Jesus bought me back from sin and death, so I'm a slave for Christ now. But unlike sin and death, Jesus doesn't actually require my life from me, but rather he gives me life. And that the relationship of master and slave in relation to Christ is a totally opposite, upside down, backwards relationship to the one that the world understands by slavery.
So it's almost like the thought I had coming up is almost that the world sees this bare-boned, this is what slavery is, the gods are capricious, you just hope they don't come to the field where you're at and make you do something stupid. Or if they do come, maybe they're feeling good today because like something else awesome happened and you get like awesome sauce. Yay, great.
Right, luck.
As opposed to, yeah, I am a slave of Christ, but also being a slave of Christ means I am a baptized into Christ. I'm a brother of Christ. We're fellow heirs. We're free.
It's a weird paradox. You're free by being a slave.
There is this entire spiritual reality, this truth of whom God is and whom he calls us to be over and above that the world cannot see. And so while the world is focused on all these vain, fleeting things and think that's the way the world works, no, there's an entire reality that you guys don't pick up on. So don't run after the stuff you see. Remember the great realities, the great truth.
Which covers that takes us through verse 5 all the way then into verse 7, actually, to piggyback off your question.
that worked.
No, we meant to do that. Totally. Therefore, subject yourselves to God. There it is, right there. Bend your knee. Literally, bend your knee to God. Like, assume the position of worship. But not, again, not subject yourself in the sense of, I'm your slave, do with me as you wish, but rather subject in the form of worship. Like, bend the knee. And that, you're God, I'm not. Give grace to me because I'm not important. Again, the word, God gives grace to the humble. Humble. I don't really consider myself to be that important, Lord. I'm of no importance whatsoever. And that's when you get the gift. The charis, the grace. But resist the devil and he'll run away from you. Jeez. Draw near to God and he'll draw near to you. Oh, finally we get to do something, Pastor Brown. We get to make a decision to turn our life and our wills over to Jesus as we understand him. Because James says so. Isn't that what James says?
If you're trying to latch onto that to be suddenly the, look at what I'm doing. Yay! Well, you're kind of missing the point. You've already, be subject to me. Come, you have God standing here saying, come over here. If I go and grab my son and pull him close to me, and then he says, oh, yes, Dad is pulling me away from these scary whatever, and he huddles up closer, that's what it's talking about. It's not a matter of, well, I must go and go on my moral quest to try and come closer to God. Well, no, look. Look, he's right here calling you with, here's grace, here's life, here's mercy, here's all. Okay, yeah. Ooh. So it's that I almost like the image of when I'm trying to pull my son close and he finally says, yeah, okay, I need a hug, and comes in for the hug. That's that image. And then there's safety, there's security, there's all that good stuff.
So cleanse your hands, purify your hearts, lament, mourn, and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to, well, gloominess, you know. Cast your eyes down.
It's Psalm 51.
Humble yourselves. Yeah, it is exactly that.
It's playing off that whole thing. Create in me a clean heart, O God. Renew a right spirit within me. Why a broken and contrite heart? You're not going to despise. Think about how odd that is. Do the pagan slave gods want broken and contrite hearts? Well, no, because then they can't do anything for them.
Right.
If you are a pagan god, what you do is you kind of go and you use the humans as your proxies. Because, I mean, you don't want to just go Athena doesn't want to just mess with Ares straight on, because that gets really bad and violent. So I'll go encourage Odysseus and he can go take out Hector. Take that. Ha ha. Or actually be Achilles. But you get the point. And you want heroes. You want them big and strong and powerful, and it's a completely backwards and different approach from the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. Again, lament, mourn, and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloominess. Humble yourselves before the Lord and he will raise you up. This is so counterintuitive to us, I think, in the present tense, because we live in such a positivistic culture that everything that is geared towards, pleasure, happiness. Riffing off of what James here actually says is that, you know, your chasing after pleasure is the reason we have wars and murder and envy and arguments and strife. And the reason that you're an adulterous people and you've turned away from your bridegroom is because you desire pleasure more than God. So when you turn and you receive grace, not only are you showing that you're not as important as you think you are, but you're also showing that the stuff that you think you can't live without is like a puff of smoke. It's like vapor. It's like mist in the morning. It's like fog in the morning. That's all it is. It's like breath of breaths, vanity of vanities. That's all your desire for pleasure is. And so lament and mourn and weep over, well, yourself, actually. That's the thing. Like, you need to mourn yourself because you've been chased. Like, you've been running the complete wrong direction if this is what you think this is about.
You mean this isn't weep because I'm not exercising enough of the power of positive thinking to get the awesome success that I need?
Well, and remember what he says in chapter 2 about how they want to elevate rich people and wealthy people to a higher status than the poor. Because they want to be like that. They want those rewards and benefits that come from hanging around with rich, influential people. And here he's saying, all that stuff that you're chasing after, the wealth, the influence, the power, the privilege, the social status, all of that stuff is leading you away from the truth, leading you away from God to, again, be double-minded, to serve other gods, to serve two masters. And that's the problem, is that that direction is death and sin and the devil. This direction is grace. Those are your two choices. Grace or sin, death, and the devil. Those are your choices.
Draw near? Is that a draw near? Would that be a repent word then?
It would be, right?
You think? I mean, that's...
Well, again, going back to the image of the bride and the bridegroom and him calling them adulterous, do you draw near your husband or your spouse when they're in trouble, or do you push them away and go, do what you want to her, but leave me alone?
No, there is that closeness that is to be ideal. That is the point. Not right. Just ideal, but that's why.
So don't speak evil about each other. The one who speaks evil of his brother or judges his brother speaks evil of the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you're not a doer of the law. You are a judge of the law. And I'm afraid to tell you this, but there's one lawgiver. There's one judge who's able to save and destroy. And it ain't you, Jack. But who are you to judge your neighbor? That is crazy.
Don't you understand, Pastor Riley? That person over there did bad and they really need to get it. What am I letting predominate my whole attitude and approach then?
Well, my desire to feel good about myself, actually.
Oh. Well, see, this is one of the things that comes up so often with the desire to punish. It really isn't about punishing it. It's setting the rank. It's
right.
Demonstrating that I am better.
I could care. If you do something that I disagree with, all right, you do something I don't like, I could care less about quote-unquote punishment. All I want to know is, how am I going to get a, like, how do I benefit from catching you doing something wrong or unrighteous? That's really what the root is here.
Well, can you believe that they, well, I never.
Right.
And
he always, she never. Did you see what they did? Did you hear what so-and-so said?
Well, this is part of the reason why gossip is so entertaining, especially if it's salacious, because then we can feel all sanctified because it sets the bar of wickedness so high. Well, I don't really have to mourn because I haven't done what so-and-so did.
Exactly.
I haven't pulled a Gillespie yet, so I mean, I'm perfectly fine.
That's right. But this is difficult because, you know, it's 2,000 years later and we're still arguing. We've argued this into meaninglessness at this point, actually, when it says, you're not the lawgiver, you're not the judge, and so who are you to judge your neighbor? Now, as soon as the words come out, who are you to judge your neighbor, we all automatically start figuring out ways to justify how that sentence doesn't mean what it says. Because surely he doesn't mean that we're never to judge. I mean, you know, who are you to judge your neighbor means that he's not saying that I should never judge my neighbor. He just means in certain circumstances. But I should totally judge my neighbor if fill in the blank.
No. Well, okay, I'm going to make a caveat. If your God-given vocation is that of judge for temporal things, but in terms of eternity, in terms of spiritual things, my job is not to see, all right, God, you make sure this guy ends up in hell because he really needs it. Well, if I'm saying that, I'm saying this guy's sin trumps Christ on the cross, which is a really dumb thing to say.
Right. And just like in three, he's constantly referencing one. In four, he's constantly referencing two here because, again, if you break even one part of the law, you're responsible for the entire law. And so those of you who want to be, who want to judge the law, you can't just judge the eighth commandment and say, well, I disagree with how you interpret the eighth commandment. And I stand here and go, well, I disagree with how you misinterpret the third commandment. No. If you want to judge one piece of the law, one part of the law, you've got to judge the entire law. You're responsible for judging the entire, and you're not judging the law, you're judging God, because it's God's word of law. It's not law in a sense of an idea that's just kind of like floating around in the air waiting for you to like grab it and pump it up with meaning. This is God's very word, the law, that he's spoken. And so to judge the law, you are standing in the place of God.
The first example of man judging the law is Adam saying, God, the woman you gave me led me astray.
That's right. It's not my fault.
You messed up. Now punish her. Send her away. Do something bad to her.
Be gone, woman.
I will not draw near to her, as you have told me to. I will not be with the woman you gave me to be your helpmeet. I will say, here's the bus. Run
over.
That's right.
And if I, you know, and this no longer gives me pleasure. This relationship is no longer pleasurable. She does not please me.
When Eve saw that the fruit was appealing to the eye. Pleasurable.
Yeah. So desirous. So come, you say today or tomorrow, and then all of a sudden he just goes off on a jag in a different direction. Today or tomorrow, we're going to travel over there or over there, and we'll stay in that city, and we'll live there for a year, and we'll make a business, and we'll make a profit. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, man. What you don't know what your life's going to be like tomorrow. You're a vapor. You're mist. You're breath of breath. You're vanity. You appear, and then you're gone. Instead, say this. If this is what the Lord wants, then we'll live, and we'll do this, or we'll do that. But don't boast. That's just arrogance. All boasting is evil. All boasting is evil. Therefore, to the one who knows to do good and doesn't do it, it's a sin.
It's actually a beautiful transition, because if you cross out the big bold letters that say boasting about tomorrow or whatever the title is, look, you're running after passions. How far are you willing to run after your passions, your pleasures? You want to get up and move. You've already been kicked to the four winds and scattered throughout, and you're going to move again. Why? Right. To try and make some money. And not just because you think you might, but, oh, yeah, I'm going to go do it. You know, okay, if you go over there, the Lord may give you some financial success. Don't boast about it, because you know what?
It's from God.
Yeah. Oh, what a good boy am I. No. Why are you stealing God's thunder? Why you gotta steal God's glory, man?
And remember, going back to chapter 2 again, those rich people, those wealthy people that you envy, that you want to be like, and so you jump from town to town trying to make your fortune the way they did, remember what I said about them? Well, in case you forgot, when we come back next week to chapter 5, James is going to go a little bit more in depth about those rich people that you so desperately want to imitate. So we'll wrap it up here. Pastor Brown, is there anything you want to say in closing about chapter 4?
I'm going to bring up Matthew 6 quickly.
Yeah, go ahead.
Be merciful as your Father is in heaven is merciful. And then you get judged not, lest ye be judged. Remember, God is merciful. There is only one lawgiver, one judge. And guess what? He abounds in grace and mercy and all that stuff. Everyone talks about, oh, don't judge. Well, no. Forget the verse in front of it. It's really kind
mercy,
of important.
Baby. Mercy. And he gives grace to the humble.
Over judgment. Yeah.
That's right. We thank you again for listening to us. It's been a pleasure. And come back next week for episode 5, chapter 5. We thank you for listening. And our Lord Jesus Christ bless and keep you in his baptismal grace today and forever.
Oh, amen.
See ya.
Late last time.
No, we'll get you trained in. We'll get you trained in.